Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thanks for joining us this evening for the Technology Management Program Winter Lecture Series. We're delighted to have two outstanding guests from Molecular Cellular Developmental Biology, the chair of the department, Dennis Clegg, and another great friend and colleague, Kenneth Kosick. Both of these individuals are international leaders in the domain of stem cell research. And what we wanted to investigate this evening was not only the basic science and share that, but look at some of the research insights here at University of California, Santa Barbara, and consider what careers might be impacted for you in the future. In the next 5 to 7 years, what kind of developments are going to come through and you might be able to participate in some fashion. So thank you very much for joining us. We'll have Q&A at the end of the presentations, and we'll now start with Ken Kosick. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for coming today. I'm also particularly grateful to Bill for organizing this. It's really a great pleasure for us to be here and talk about stem cells to this audience. And the way Dennis and I have thought about dividing this up is I want to begin by telling you a little bit about why stem cells are just so interesting and attractive to the biologists. And then Dennis will talk more about their application. And indeed, it's really the applications that have gotten an awful lot of attention, and deservedly so. There are, you'll hear from Dennis some amazing potentials for stem cells, some of them, some things already accomplished. But I'm going to just start by telling you why it is that stem cells in their own right are just so elegant, so beautiful, so intriguing from a purely scientific point of view. And so first, let me tell you something that you may already know, just so that we're all on the same page. When you think about where the stem cells are coming from in the first place, they come from an early embryo. And as you well know, the very first steps in the generation of the embryo is fertilization, which is the meshing of the sperm and the egg. And then that cell now, in which the DNA from the two parents has come together, that cell then begins to divide and divide and divide. And first it's 2 cells, 4, 8, 16, it's going, enlarging. And by the time it's only maybe 4 days old, it's called a blastocyst. And by the time it's about 5 or now 6 days old, there is a segment of cells, there's a little crest of cells within this blastocyst, which really at this time is, if you're looking at a book, it would be about the size of a period at the end of a sentence. If you take, there's a little rim of cells that are called the inner cell mass. And those are the cells that we take from the embryo and use them for developing embryonic stem cells. Then they can come from humans or they can come from other species. So, and once we have those cells, that's what I really want to spend the next 20 minutes or so telling you about the properties of these cells, because they are really, really special. And what is most special about them is the way they divide. When most cells divide, the two daughter cells, the products of the division, are more or less similar to each other. What happens in stem cells, what's really remarkable about stem cells, is that these cells also divide. They appear to divide more or less in half, but yet somehow, and we don't fully understand this, the two daughter cells are radically different, radically different. And they're different in their fate. One daughter cell will go on to become what we call differentiate. That is, it has the potential to become any cell in your body. And the other daughter cell remains a stem cell. It remains with it with that whole that property of what we call stemness. So how does that asymmetry occur? We really don't have a good answer for that. But what happens is that these when these when the one cell that that is going to become a differentiated cell after it after the division occurs, and it, as I say, has the potential to become any cell in your body, it doesn't do that right away. It's not like the cell divides and then suddenly it's a skin cell or a liver cell or a brain cell. What happens is that cell then has to go through a whole bunch of stages. There's all these intermediary stages. What I'm particularly interested in is the nervous system in the brain. So we study stem cells for how they're going to become neurons. When that stem cell divides, the one that is fated to become a neuron doesn't do it right away. First, it has to become what's called a proneural cell. It goes through these different stages that have different names in different species. For instance, we know a lot about how stem cells even operate in fruit flies. And there we call that cell that's on its way to become a neuron called a ganglion mother cell. There's lots of names for these cells that are on the way. So they're going through these different steps, and ultimately, through additional subsequent divisions, they will become the final cell that we are interested in for medical purposes, to replace cells in the spinal cord or replace cells in the brain. So we have this this really interesting property. Now, the next thing to think about is that the two daughter cells with these completely different fates, remember, they got the same DNA from that parent cell. Their genomes, their whole genetic code is identical. So what's making these two cells different does not lie in their genetic codes. They're doing it with the exact same DNA in the stem cell, the daughter cell that remains a stem cell, and the daughter cell that becomes differentiated. Same DNA. How does the daughter cell then go on and have such a different fate? And this difference between the two cells has given rise to an entire field that we call epigenetics. Epigenetics are things that happen to cells outside of the genome. And it is a field that is just rich with possibilities right now, because we are learning a great deal about how all of these different we're learning about the basis for many of these epigenetic phenomena. So let me tell you about what some of them are. What some of the few things that we know about. Most of the epigenetic phenomena will determine whether or not a particular gene is either turned on or turned off. Both cells have the same genes, but in one case, the gene may be turned on, and in the other case, it may not be. And that decision is often controlled epigenetically. There are modifications that occur on the DNA. We call one of them methylation, that can occur whether can decide whether a gene is turned on or turned off. Another one, there are several of them. One that in my own laboratory we are particularly interested in and doing a large number of studies is an epigenetic method, an epigenetic mechanism called microRNAs. MicroRNAs are small RNAs, about 21 nucleotides long. Remember, a gene can be thousands and thousands of nucleotides long. A microRNA is just about 21 nucleotides, and its whole job in life is simply to control other RNAs, the products of other genes, whether they're going to turn into protein or not. That's all they do. So if you remember the days from high school when you learned the central dogma of biology was DNA to RNA to protein, we know that, and certainly there's no doubt that that is true, but there's another phenomena that is equally important, which is DNA to RNA stop. Just stop right there, and that RNA, working epigenetically, turns out to be a critically important control element for deciding the fate of the daughter cell that is going to become skin, liver, brain, whatever. Now, you have these two cells now. So just think. So let's go back into what I was originally talking about. Two daughter cells, very different fates. Now, you can imagine that maybe the division got a little bit messed up. Maybe that one of the properties of the stem cell is that it can proliferate. One of the properties of the differentiated cell is that it stops proliferating. Well, if you just sort of think this out now, proliferation, and you just do a little bit of free association in your mind. For a biologist, once we start thinking about proliferation, you might think about proliferation out of control, and suddenly you're thinking about cancer. So when the cells divide, and you have one that remains a stem cell, you can imagine that it is tottering on the edge of perhaps overdoing its proliferative capacity and slipping into a carcinogenic state. That's the boundary that stem cells are always on. They're always on this very fine edge of slipping into cancer. How about the other cell? What can happen there if the cell doesn't get enough of its properties? If the one daughter cell gets too much stemness, for instance, perhaps the other daughter cell might have some other property too. What could it get that would be a potential problem down the road? Well, what's the opposite of cancer? The opposite of cancer is when our cells die prematurely or degeneration. For instance, Alzheimer's disease, when brain cells are dying. So whatever these properties are in cells that have to somehow segregate between the two, whatever they are, they're probably epigenetic, we don't know much more, whatever they are, they can have consequences many, many generations later. Because that stem cell is setting up the fate of every cell in your body. And it could be that the original stem cell, when it divided, at some point going through those intermediates, ended up giving a little too much stemness to a cell that ended up in your thyroid gland, for instance, and that predisposed you to malignancy. Or a little bit too much differentiation properties that ended up in your brain that then led to Alzheimer's disease. I want to tell you that this idea is something that is simply a hypothesis. This is not something that you can go into the lab or go into a textbook and say, this is a fact in biology right now. But it is, there is a very strong possibility, I think, that if we fully understood how stem cells really are separating the components for these two different fates, we would end up, at least I believe as a hypothesis, that we would have profound insights into cancer and neurodegeneration. So So that is when we begin with the stem cell itself. And now I want to tell you about another major advance in this field that also has implications to everything that I've been talking about. This was a scientific finding by Jamie Thompson and another independently by Yamanaka, who, and it was awarded the best papers of the year by Science Magazine this year. It has been gotten an awful lot of attention. It basically is the discovery of what is called reprogramming or induced pluripotent stem cells. And with that, what I mean by that word is that you already know you can take a cell from the inner cell mass, a stem cell, and make it any cell in the body. But now you can take any cell in the body and turn it back into a stem cell. Probably any cell in the body. Not everyone has been checked yet, but so far a number of them have, and they have the ability to go backward now. So now we have two arrows. We have this forward arrow and a backward arrow. And again, if you think about it, we already knew there was a backward arrow because cells that are differentiated can turn into cancer cells, and that must be a backward kind of arrow. But this is a more precise backward arrow that takes you precisely back to the stem cell. Now, how do they do that? They basically introduced some genes that encode proteins that turn on four different genes that are involved in creating a stem cell identity. And they searched a long time to find those four, but they landed on four. The two groups found slightly different four genes, so there's actually not just four. There's probably more genes that can do it. And the question we're left with is that how really did those cells go backwards so readily? They must have. If you go backward, do you have to go in reverse through all the intermediary steps? Or can you jump all the steps and get right back to a stem cell? That's not really answered yet. We don't know. And what we do know is that, once again, these epigenetic phenomena are controlling the identity of our cells, keeping the cells within boundaries. How come your cells that are in your kidney stay kidney cells? How do they maintain that? Those cells are dividing, or if you cut yourself and you grow some new skin, how do those cells stay skin cells? Why don't they slip into something else? Why don't they slip into some other intermediary state? Well, these microRNAs and other epigenetic phenomena are involved in setting up these identity boundaries of cells so that cells are what they're intended to be. And somehow, in ways we don't fully understand, the reprogramming is able to overcome the cell's natural tendency to just stay what it is and regress to something that it was, a stem cell. Now, most recently, so this finding has really excited the field tremendously, and we're doing work here on these what are called induced pluripotent stem cells. And now what people are doing is once you get, I take a skin cell from somebody in this audience, we turn it back into a stem cell, and now we want to send the arrow back the other way. Take a cell that's actually your cell, has your DNA, and now make it into a kidney cell or a brain cell. And that would be, say, a brain cell that now has your DNA and can be used to fix medical problems that are specific for you. Remember, we took the original stem cell from some unknown embryo that did not have the same DNA that you have. So if we made it into something that would replace some tissue in your body, there's an incompatibility problem. But with the induced pluripotent stem cells, we can use your very cells to replace your tissues that may become damaged. We're not there yet, but that is the promise of this technique. So the last thing I was going to say is that there now is one more finding of which there's only just been one paper to my knowledge, which has even taken this these concepts of changing cell identities even further. And this is work that was done by another very well-known stem cell biologist named Doug Melton, who has now used, again, certain genes that will turn on and turn off other genes to take a cell that comes from the pancreas. And the pancreas, remember, has lots of different cells in it that are all making these digestive juices and things, and that buried within the pancreas, there's another type of cell called the beta islet cell, which is the cell that gets into trouble in diabetes. So in the pancreas, beta islet cells are small nests of cells surrounded by lots of other cells that are doing more digestive things than controlling your sugar. And what he did was he was able to now, and the technical word here might be to trans-differentiate. He took the already differentiated pancreatic cell and converted it directly into a beta islet cell. Another word for this technique is called direct reprogramming. Now, that is truly amazing. I mean, that is just extraordinary, because now, think about those arrows I was telling you about. How did that happen? Now, he was able to skip going back to the stem cell at all. Who cares about the stem cell? It's taking a shortcut to taking some cell that had already arrived at its fate and now redirecting it to some other state. And we don't know very much about the intermediate states, but there must be all these different intermediate states that are operating to keep the cells within these bounds and that need to be overcome when you're trying to do this kind of biologic magic, which will change cellular identity. So I will end right there and turn it over to Dennis.
All right, well, thank you. And I'm going to take off from where Ken left you and use some PowerPoint. I know you missed PowerPoint. It's been half an hour, and you're dying to see PowerPoint again. So let's see if I can do this here. It appears my laptop's been turned off, so hang on one second. Okay. All right, well, Ken told you about where stem cells come from, and here's just a picture of that. This is a five-day-old human blastocyst, and it's at about 128 cells, and the inner cell mass that Ken referred to is this mass of cells right here. It's called a blastocyst because it has it's basically a spherical hollow ball, and these inner cell mass cells reside sort of on the ceiling of that hollow ball. So these are the guys that are going to go on to make the entire body, and if we take them out at this time, we can turn them into embryonic stem cells. And one thing I wanted to mention is where these cells come from. A lot of people ask that question, where do you get these five-day-old blastocysts? Well, it turns out during the process of in vitro fertilization, excess blastocysts are generated, and they don't use all of them. They use some and freeze down the rest, and then once, if the pregnancy is successful, then they have a number of cells just sitting in the freezer, and it's estimated that there are 400,000 frozen blastocysts in vitro fertilization clinics around the country that will eventually be discarded. So we can use these, if the couple consents, to do research. So that's where they come from. And I'm going to talk about some of the applications of stem cells, and I'm going to start with this picture here. Now, it's ski season. it didn't seem like a ski day today, but this is a picture that's amazing in at least three different ways. First thing that's amazing is that this guy is going down a hill at 65 miles per hour. Pretty amazing. Second amazing thing is that he's blind. And this is the world champion, or he was the world champion blind ski racer. His name is Michael May, and he lives in Davis, California. But the most amazing thing about him is that his blindness has been cured in one eye through a stem cell transplant. It turns out there's a type of stem cell in the cornea, corneal stem cell or limbal cell, that in the early 1990s, scientists figured out that they could implant these stem cells along with a cornea from a donor and get the cornea to come back. Now, he was blinded at age 3 by a chemical spill, and so it's his cornea that's affected, not his retina. But he was able to regain sight in one eye. And there's a great book called Crashing Through about his life that I encourage you to read. Now, the point of this is that there are stem cell treatments that are already taking place. And sometimes people ask, how long is it going to be before we have stem cell treatments? Well, we already have them. This is one example. And, of course, a bone marrow transplant is another type of stem cell procedure, stem cell transplant that's in use today and is very successful. But a lot of people are excited about these embryonic stem cells because they could be applied to a wide variety of diseases, including Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, Ken mentioned, also spinal cord injury, heart disease, and macular degeneration. And I'm just going to talk about a couple of these today in the time that I have. I'll talk about work going on in the area of spinal cord injury, and then end with some research here at UC Santa Barbara related to this disease, macular degeneration. I wanted, though, to also sound some caution, because there's a lot of hype about stem cell research, and sometimes when you hear people, you think, oh my God, it's going to cure everything, and it sounds a little like snake oil. There are some challenges that we have to overcome to make these therapies successful. First of all, the cells may not integrate and function in a particular disease due to the damage that's already existing in the tissue. Some diseases have tremendous amounts of loss of tissue or scarring, and to put in a fresh cell and expect it to repair everything might be asking a bit much. So we just don't know if this is going to be a barrier, and we have to try therapies to see if that's a problem. Another one that Ken mentioned is that the cells would be recognized as foreign tissue and be rejected by the immune system. If you take a human embryonic stem cell that's from another person and grow up a cell and put it in your own body, it would be recognized as a foreign invader and rejected. So that's a problem. And then finally, as Ken mentioned, these cells are very close to a carcinogenic state. These embryonic stem cells, in their undifferentiated form, grow like crazy. They grow forever, as far as we can tell, and they may form a tumor. In fact, a common assay to see if these cells are indeed embryonic pluripotent stem cells is to transplant them into a mouse, and they form a tumor called a teratoma that tends to differentiate into hair and teeth and bone, and it's a teratoma. Literally, it means a terrible-looking tumor. And so we have to be careful if we're going to have therapies that we don't cure one disease and cause another. Okay, now Ken mentioned a possible solution to this problem number two, which is a big problem. You know, we could put in transplants and use immune-suppressing drugs, but that's no picnic, and it'd be better if we could somehow make a patient-specific cell. And Ken mentioned this, this reprogramming to become stem cells, where you can start with a skin cell and turn it into a stem cell. This was called an astonishing experiment by Ian Wilmot, very surprising when it was reported, and cellular alchemy by another reviewer, where you're sort of taking a lead cell and turning it into a golden cell. And as Ken mentioned, this was done in two places by Shinya Yamanaka in Kyoto, inserting four genes, and here are the names. These are transcription factors that regulate turning DNA into RNA. And then here in the U.S., Jamie Thompson used four slightly different genes, a different combination, to do the same thing. And now we know you can actually do this with three of these genes and possibly even two. And we may be able to do it without inserting genes into the DNA. That's what people are working on now. The original reports actually used a virus, including one that was related to the AIDS virus, to insert these genes into the cells. And we're trying to now do this without inserting into the genome. So these are called iPS cells, or induced pluripotent stem cells, and have, so far, all of the properties of a typical embryonic stem cell. So here you could have a patient match cell that wouldn't be rejected by the immune system. Now, Jamie Thompson, who carried out this work at the University of Wisconsin, is also an adjunct professor here in our department in molecular biology at UCSB, and he's co-director of our Center for Stem Cell Biology and Engineering here at UCSB. And I'll tell you a little bit more about some of the work going on there as well. Jamie has a satellite laboratory that he operates here at Santa Barbara and has a position as adjunct in our department. Okay, so that's a second kind of stem cell. There's embryonic stem cells. There's induced pluripotent stem cells. There are also adult stem cells, right? You've probably heard about people that are studying adult stem cells from, for example, bone marrow, as I mentioned before. That's a type of adult stem cell. But also in skin, even in brain, testicle, intestine, blood, and muscle, there are populations of stem cells that might be used to treat disease. So that brings up the question, well, which is the best stem cell? Embryonic stem cells, induced pluripotent stem cells, or adult stem cells? Which one do you use? And some people argue, let's use adult stem cells, and we avoid the controversy of using embryonic stem cells. Well, I just wanted to compare them just briefly here in a table to go through the advantages and disadvantages of each cell type. Now, embryonic stem cells are pluripotent. They can make every cell in the body. They can grow forever, so they have an infinite lifespan. But we've mentioned the disadvantages. They might make a tumor. Their ethical concerns, their legal problems in some countries, and there's this problem of immune rejection. Now, adult stem cells, they don't have the ability to form tumors. They're less likely to form tumors, fewer ethical concerns, but they have a limited potential. They can't turn into everything. Typically, they're called multipotent cells, and they have a short lifespan. You can't grow them for very long before they senesce and die. Now, induced pluripotent stem cells, comparing them to embryonic stem cells, the induced pluripotent stem cells have the advantage that there are fewer ethical and legal concerns and no immune rejection, but they still have a potential for tumor formation. And the way they've been made so far is to insert these genes into the genome, and you can actually cause cancer by inserting in the wrong place and turning on the wrong gene. So it's called insertional mutagenesis. And that's a problem, which I think we're close to solving. It's been solved in mouse, and soon will be, I think, reported in human. But at this point, we just don't know the answer to that question that I posed, which stem cell is the best. And we really need to do research on all of these three types of cells to figure out which one's going to work the best for which disease. Okay, well, I mentioned the legal status, and as you know, stem cells have become somewhat of a political football in the past years. In 2001, you might remember, George Bush limited federally funded research to pre-existing stem cell lines. And he said there were 64 of those, and we don't need to make any more lines, we can just use those. The problem with this is that there weren't really 64 lines, there were more like 16 lines that were available, and all were unsuitable for human therapy because they contain mouse cell surface molecules. They were grown on a feeder layer of mouse cells. They pick up mouse sugar groups, and so they would be rapidly rejected by the immune system if they were put into a human for therapy. Well, as you know, we just had an election, and here comes Barack Obama through the surf, and we don't know what he's going to do. He has said in the campaign trail that he would lift the ban imposed by President Bush, and we're waiting to see what will happen there. And he's also said he would increase funding at the federal level for stem cell research. There's a very limited amount of money available. Well, as you probably remember, in 2004, California, because of Bush's policies, voted for a proposition. Here's California made out of stem cells. I guess this is the California view. It's even got the Channel Islands here. I like that. We passed Proposition 71 that sold bonds to raise money for state-funded stem cell research and created the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And they've been giving out money for stem cell research across the state now for 2 years to the tune of $300 million a year. And we've been able to garner several grants to help our programs here. We have a training program in stem cell biology and engineering that funds postdocs and grad students. We have two renovation projects going on for a new center and a shared stem cell laboratory, and then a tools and technology grant to support bioengineering research. Anybody know who that is? Christopher Reeve. Most people say Superman, but either answer is correct. That's right. That's Christopher Reeve, the actor who played Superman. And he died in 2004, before Prop 71 was passed. But he and his wife, Dana, went on for a long time to raise money for spinal cord injury research. And as you know, he fell off a horse, actually in 1995, and broke his back and was in a wheelchair for many years. Dana herself actually passed away in 2006, but one of the things they did was to establish the Reeve Irvine Research Center that's focused on research on spinal cord injury. And I'm going to just show you one result here, actually from Evan Snyder, who is at Harvard and now is at the Burnham Institute in San Diego, but similar work has gone on in Irvine. What they do is induce a spinal cord injury in a rat. And here's a control animal that you can see can't use its hind legs very much. And what they do is just go in and pinch the spinal cord with a forceps, and they get this result. In this paper, what they did was to put in neural stem cells, actually an adult stem cell type, but it also works with embryonic stem cells. And what you'll see next is a rat that has an implant of stem cells along with a unique polymer scaffold. And here's 70 days later, and look at the difference. Now, the rat's not entirely normal, but you can see they even have trouble keeping up with him with the camera, and an amazing transformation compared to that control rat that I showed you first. Now, this has people very excited about using stem cells to treat spinal cord injury. And you may have read in the newspaper last Friday the first FDA-approved human trial is now on track for spinal cord injury using human embryonic stem cells that have been turned into oligodendrocytes, a type of glial cell that's important in the spinal cord function, that'll go on with the researchers at the Reeve Center in Irvine, Hans Kierstedt, and a company called Geron up in the Bay Area. Now, interestingly, this got approved right after Obama became president. They speculate here as to whether or not that may have had something to do with the timing, but everybody in the field is very excited about this, but also a little nervous because this is going to be big, and we hope we don't, you know, form tumors in somebody. They'll first do a safety trial and then try and treat people and see if they can do the same thing that's been done in rats. It's a very exciting time. Well, I want to end with just some work going on here at UCSB in the Neuroscience Research Institute, which I can almost point out right about there, and talk about what we've been able to establish here. Now, we don't have a medical school, but we still think we can contribute to this field of stem cell research and regenerative medicine. We've established a Center for Stem Cell Biology and Engineering, and the website is shown here if you want to read more, but the idea is that we think we can contribute in the areas of molecular mechanisms of stem cell pluripotency and proliferation, basic biology. There's still a lot of questions. As Ken mentioned, we don't really understand everything about how stem cells grow and how they divide and then differentiate into particular cells. And then with the engineering here on campus, there are a lot of engineering problems in this field. How do you control the growth of these if you're making them for the clinic? How do you control differentiation? And how can you deliver them and keep them in the right place? That's actually a huge problem in the field. And then finally, we are collaborating with other universities and other medical schools with directed research targeted at particular diseases, such as cancer, macular degeneration, kidney disease, Alzheimer's, and a little bit on autism. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about macular degeneration. And age-related macular degeneration, as it's sometimes called, is one of the leading causes of blindness in this country, and it affects older people mostly. And it's characterized by a progressive loss of fine acuity vision in the central portion of the visual field. So if you have this disease and you look out on the street, you might see something like this, where the central portion of your visual field is entirely blacked out. And it's a huge problem in this country. Something like 4 out of 10 people over the age of 70 have some symptoms of this disease. There's no real cure for this disease, and we're trying to figure out what goes on and how we can treat it. Now, we know a little bit about the progression of the disease. There's a layer of cells in the back of the eye called the RPE, or retinal pigment epithelium. When you look in somebody's pupil, it's black, and that's because you see this black layer of cells behind the retina. And in this disease, these cells die, and they're supporting photoreceptors, and those photoreceptors then die. And they know that the immune system is involved in some cases, and they think toxic byproducts may accumulate in the cells, and it's an area of active study. But it's a candidate for cell-based therapeutics. If we could replace these RPE cells, maybe we could treat this disease. Now that leads me to the final exam. I hope you all knew there was an exam today and brought your blue books. But I'm going to make it easy for you. I'm going to make it multiple choice. What is a macula? That's your final exam. And here are your choices. A, the newest version of the Macintosh computer. B, a Scottish cousin of Count Dracula. Or C, the centralmost part of the retina responsible for detailed sharp vision. Anybody? C, very good. Please mark down A plus for everyone in the class. That's what it is. I kind of gave it away. I should have showed this first. It's a tiny part of the retina. Here's a cross-section of the eye, and the retina is this yellow layer right here. And it's about 1/10 of an inch in diameter that includes the fovea right in the back of the eye. And that's why it affects your central vision. As you're looking out, that's the part of the vision that's destroyed in this disease. And we don't know why it affects the macula more than other parts of the retina, but certainly that's where it appears first, and then it tends to spread throughout the eye. So how would therapy work? Well, it's known that human embryonic stem cells, and now we've shown iPS cells, can differentiate into RPE-like cells. And if these cells are truly authentic RPE, then we could replace the damaged RPE and replace and prevent the loss of vision that occurs if we could catch it at the right time. So I'm just going to show you a couple of pictures here of data. The way we make these cells is actually they're easy to make. They appear spontaneously. If we just take a big petri dish of human embryonic stem cells and take away their growth factor, they start to differentiate into muscle, neurons, heart cells. You can see beating heart cells. But in 2004, Klimanskaya et al. Noticed these little pigmented patches that would pop up in the dish. This is probably, you know, a billion cells right here. So it's a very small percentage of cells, and it takes 6 to 8 weeks. But they analyze these cells, and they appear very similar to RPE cells. We've collaborated with the Klimanskaya group at Advanced Cell Technology and now derived lines of our own. And here's a picture of these cells. After you pick them out of a dish like I showed, they make very nice retinal pigment epithelial cells that look just like human embryonic retinal pigment epithelial cells. And I'll just show you a couple pictures here of this is the HESC-derived RPE right here, looked at in the electron microscope, and you can see these melanin granules. That's what gives them the pigment. And they have these apical microvilli that are typical of RPE. And here's a native RPE where you can see the same melanin granules and these long extensions coming off the top of the cells. So they look like real RPE. And if we analyze the genes that they express in this microarray experiment where we've compared the HESC-derived RPE and the fetal human RPE, a fetal human RPE sample, plotting the genes against each other so that if these two were identical, they would all fall on this diagonal line, you can see there's good clustering right around that diagonal. It's not perfect. Some are way off, expressed higher in one than the other. But if you do the correlation coefficient, it has a correlation coefficient of 0.94, very, very similar in global gene expression patterns to the fetal human RPE. So we think these might be useful to treat the disease. We've also looked at the localization of proteins known to be in normal RPE. And what I'm showing here, if we just look at this top panel, this is a real human RPE from a slice of a donor eye from a cadaver. And it's stained for a protein called emprin, which appears in green. And then there's some autofluorescent stuff in the lysosomes called lipofuscin, which appears in red. Here are human stem cell-derived RPE over here. And you can see the green label here is mostly on the bottom, and over here it's mostly on the bottom. It's similar but not identical to the actual cells taken from the eye. Of course, these were grown in a dish. These were grown in an eye. So there are likely to be some differences, but the expression pattern of a number of proteins that we've looked at is similar but not identical. And then you may have noticed there's a lot more red stuff in this one compared to this one. And that may be a good thing. Lipofuscin accumulates in the lysosomes and is thought to be partially toxic byproducts that kill these cells. And the older one gets, the more lipofuscin one has in their RPE cells. So we're putting in RPE cells, virgin RPE cells really, that have never seen an eye before, and they haven't yet accumulated these toxic byproducts. So there's less lipofuscin in the stem cell-derived RPE, and that may be a good thing. I'm going to skip this slide because it's a little complicated, but the cells have been put into a rat model of human retinal disease called the RCS rat, and they can cause restoration of vision in these animals that normally go blind, and that's because of an RPE defect, and I don't have time to go through it, but the next step is to try larger animals, do more animal trials with these cells, and then eventually move to clinical trials with human. And some speculate that macular degeneration will be the second disease that will be treated with a stem cell therapy. And we hope that we can contribute to that. We're collaborating with clinical centers at the University of Southern California and at UC Irvine to try and take the cells that we make and get them into clinical trials, hopefully within the next 5 years or so. So I think I'll stop there, and I just wanted to acknowledge some of the people that carried out the work I showed you, including Sherry Hakita and Kiri Hu in my lab. Sherry runs our shared stem cell laboratory and really helps to coordinate all of the stem cell research on campus. I also want to acknowledge Jamie Thompson, who's helped us immensely get started in this and continues to provide advice and helps run the center. The folks at ACT that helped us early on, Dean Bach at UCLA, and Erki Ruoslahti, who's here on campus and has established a branch of the famous Burnham Institute at UCSB, who's also participating in our studies. And then finally, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine for funding, and as well as local sources and private donors. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis and Ken. We'll go on to questions now. Is there any kind of question for our guests?
Okay, maybe to take it back to what the one objective for the talks were, how do the people in the audience, how can they see themselves in jobs in the future? You know, you gave a couple of examples, but maybe there's some, you didn't really go into what could engineers do, what could biologists do, what could people in economists do, and that sort of thing. And that's
you want, I'll...
Well, yeah, so I mentioned some of the research and the challenges there, and they're both challenges in biology and in engineering. And if this technology goes into the clinic, there are going to be a lot of jobs associated with that, you know, making the cells, checking the cells to make sure they're the right thing, doing engineering-type approaches to make synthetic matrices to grow the cells on, and other matrices that you can use to seed with the cells and implant into a patient. So I think it spans the whole gamut of basic research and engineering and clinical research. And there are a number of smaller companies now that are hiring in this area and starting to do research on human embryonic stem cells. It's interesting, some of the larger companies, larger pharmaceutical companies, have shied away from embryonic stem cell research because it's still pretty risky and still is going to take a few years to get into the clinic. And some of them, I think, have the strategy that they'll just let the other companies do the work, and then if they like it, they'll buy those small companies. So I think they're at least CIRM is actually funding grants to train people in this field, including people at the state college levels to run fermenters and grow cells, and as well as PhDs and postdocs to do research. So they're hoping that this will actually be a big, everybody's talking about stimulus to the economy, and I know some of the earlier studies thought that this could become a big industry in the state of California.
I mean, I would just add that this field is moving so fast that if you keep up on the science, there are going to be lots of opportunities to exploit new discoveries and take them in really unexpected directions. The time intervals here between each of these major discoveries that I talked about and Dennis talked about has been very short. All of this stuff is happening, you know, just every week we open up a journal and find something just totally surprising and unexpected. And every one of those scientific findings has opportunities for engineering, for business, for economics, for medicine. It's really a good idea to keep your eye on the science.
Dennis, there's rumors of a football game this weekend. So to put a timeline related to football in context, are we at the pregame show or the first quarter in terms of commercialization opportunities and potential?
I like the Steelers, actually.
No.
Oh, that wasn't the question. But I'm hoping the Cardinals. Yeah, good question. And you know, something to keep in mind about drug development is that it's not easy, and even for a small molecule drug, it takes $1 billion and 12 to 15 years, and the failure rate for drugs is about 90%. So now we're talking about a cellular therapy. There are cellular therapies out there, as I mentioned, but I think we all have to be patient. It's going to take some time. That's the one question we get all the time, from especially from patients and families of patients, is when are you going to cure diabetes or a spinal cord injury? And it's really, I think, going to be a matter of years, you know, not months, certainly, and maybe 10 to 15 to 20 years before this really takes hold. But the encouraging thing is we're going to be starting in clinical trials later this year with the first human embryonic. And there are a number of adult stem cells that are already in clinical trials.
Yeah, you're really... To know where the goalpost is, you have to really know what disease you're targeting. So if you saw Dennis's picture about the rat, that for spinal cord injury, we're really very optimistic. For macular degeneration, from Dennis's work, we're very optimistic. I think on that list are also diseases like Alzheimer's disease, which may be a little... you know, a little overly optimistic to have that right on our list at this time.
I was just wondering if you could talk about the state of stem cell research in different environments, like in other countries, the funding environment's different and the ethical environment is different.
Right. The federal restriction on stem cell research I think, did put us a little behind compared to other countries. Other countries, especially the UK and Singapore, for example, Japan, really put a lot of money into this research early on, and they've, in some ways, gotten a jump on us. Other countries don't even touch the research because of ethical concerns. So it varies, and of course it varies from state to state. We, in California, I think are set to really become a major world leader in this area because of the investment that we're making. And it's really the wisdom and the foresight, I think, of the people of the state that supported Prop 71 and decided that this was a good thing and does have a very exciting potential and good future. But other states, you know, have passed laws saying no embryonic cells in the state, and so it really does vary from state to state. It's interesting, though, politically, it's an issue that sort of crosses traditional political lines. You can find liberals that are anti-stem cell research because of their religious beliefs, and you can find conservatives that are very pro-stem cell research, so it's interesting in that way.
I would also point out that we have been a little bit discouraged in the stem cell community about some of the restrictions that were in place over the past 8 years. On the other hand, just about all of the major advances that have come about in the last couple of years have come from this country. And that includes the work from Jamie Thompson in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It includes the work from Doug Melton in Boston. And even Yamanaka is now in San Francisco. So while we really complained a lot about the situation, the scientists in this country were still leading the game.
That's a good point.
Ken Kosick and Dennis Clegg, thank you so much for joining us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.